Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What sort of partnership did James Madison and Thomas Jefferson have? And how did their personal and political relationship shape the course of American history? Thomas Jefferson was born 8 years before the man who would succeed him as president, and most modern accounts portray the relationship as one of mentorship of James Madison by his elder fellow Virginian. But as my guests today have discovered, Jefferson might not have been the man we remember today, and in fact might not have been president at all were it not for the hard work and influence of James Madison. Andrew Burstein is Charles P. Manship Professor of History at Louisiana State University. Nancy Eisenberg is Professor of History also at LSU. Their new book is called Madison and Jefferson. Nancy, Andy, welcome to Think.
Good to be with you.
Yes.
Starting this off, it might be helpful to talk about something that you communicate very well in the book, which is that in many ways, American society in the 18th century was so different from ours today that it can almost be likened to that of the culture of a foreign country. Will you talk about that?
Well, in Jefferson's and Madison's political partnership, they were confronting a world in which a state-sponsored church held power. They considered this to be a form of tyranny. It was a world in which republics were really not known except in their ancient form. They looked back to the Greeks and the Romans for examples of good government. And they were trying to put forward an enlightened view of what a republic would and should be like, and that America was new and untested and morally superior to the old world. This was what prompted their idealism about the future of America. But what we do in our book is to show in graphic detail the bitterness of political partisanship that Madison and Jefferson contended with, and had to devise a means of dealing with if they were going to succeed against the forces of what they considered to be monarchy, aristocracy, and tyranny.
Because quite literally everything was at stake at that point.
Yeah, I mean, I think what we tend to forget is that the outcome of the American Revolution was uncertain. For Jefferson and Madison, they really saw themselves as Virginians first and nationalists second. And therefore, when they imagined a political agenda, they realized that they had to protect the interests of their own state. They were very interested in promoting expansion. They were very interested in protecting what they saw as their vision of the future. But again, this returns to your first point, that the lens in which they looked at things was very much shaped by an 18th century world, and that's why jurists who try to contend that they can know the original meaning of the Constitution and somehow get inside Madison's head usually are wrong, because they don't understand the 18th century. They don't understand how central slavery was to shaping the vision of Madison and Jefferson, which has often been recognized in the story about Jefferson, but tends to be ignored when people talk about Madison.
And in fact, their ideas about the long-term place of African Americans in this country were pretty different from each other.
Now, that's a very interesting point, and I see you've been reading our book closely.
Mm-hmm.
We deal with slavery to the extent that Jefferson and Madison grappled with it, and give it about as much attention compared to other partisan political doings as we think was appropriate. Jefferson is well known for his scientific racism because he published on it. He believed, he was really the first to argue forcefully that African Americans, slaves should be freed and then a way found to return them to Africa. This was a mainstream view because racism, North and South, was profound and thought to be part of science and nature, that somehow the white races belonged on the Indians' continent, that the temperate climate was suited for a European American individual, but that the maybe the Caribbean or the equator. Certainly Africa was more the proper place for Africans and Americans to grow up. So even after generations of African Americans had begun to identify with American ideals and freed slaves, free blacks were a significant percentage of the black population, even in Virginia. Jefferson and Madison, for that matter, never abandoned the idea of colonization back to Africa to the end of their days, and they resisted the abolitionist movement in their later years. The other point that should be made is that Madison, on an individual level, was very open-minded and willing to see the talents and the intellectual abilities of African Americans. Jefferson still, for his whole life, bought into the idea of racial inferiority and racial superiority. Madison questioned that. He questioned that consistently.
The other thing that really separated their views has to do with their general philosophies, the way they looked at nation states. And Jefferson was more prone than Madison to focus on the deeper psychological forces of human behavior. He liked to imagine nations as similar to human bodies. They could suffer emotional disorders created by inflamed memories. And this is what he felt was one of the reasons that slavery would have to come to an end, because he imagined that slaves carried the horrible memories of their oppression, and that the next generation would eventually be confronted with a racial war. And he described this in very apocalyptic terms. He felt that that was almost inevitable, which emphasized the idea that the races must be separated, which reinforced his ideas of colonization. And he never really escaped that more emotional, visceral attitude, psychological view when talking about slavery. Madison was quite different. He didn't resort to those metaphors. He didn't believe that race was an impossible barrier between, you know, separating blacks and whites. He did imagine, when he first wrote about colonization, that it could serve as a useful experiment, not only proving that free blacks had the same desire for liberty and could be economically productive, but it could also prove to whites and undermine their long-held racial biases. The other thing that's remarkable is that Madison could basically interact with free blacks as social equals, which he did with Christopher McPherson, who was a former free slave, clerk of the House of Representatives, and dined with Madison and wrote about how he was treated as an equal at the table of Dolley and James Madison. He could also praise a New York free black for his economic skills, not only in running a farm, but in running a farm with white laborers. So the visceral and emotional side, which was attached to Jefferson's theory, separated him from Madison, as well as the fact that, you know, even though they shared the same commitment, the tensions between whites and blacks could not be overcome in their lifetime, and they proved inept to find any solution. Theoretically and philosophically, they treated slavery in a very different way.
We tend to think of Madison as a sort of introverted figure, but he comes across here not only as a very dogged and assertive politician, but a very deft one as well. Can you talk about that?
Well, Madison was a very innovative thinker. He had a sly sense of humor, sometimes raucous. He told and enjoyed dirty jokes. He, you know, was only 5'4" and kind of scrawny. He himself called himself, hydrophobic. He never left American shores. He was afraid that his weak constitution would prevent him from remaining healthy, and he thought he would die on the high seas. So, yet, as a Secretary of State under Jefferson, as a president during the War of 1812, he was very aggressive when it came to America's military designs. He believed, as Jefferson believed, that Canada would eventually, should be taken during the War of 1812, and an assault on Canada was planned, and an abortive attempt made. They believed that Cuba and other Spanish colonies would become part of the American Union, and Madison was responsible during his presidency for the annexation of what's called West Florida, which includes Baton Rouge, where we are right now. So the Madison who's talked about as an introvert, that completely misses his partisan personality and the fact that in the first Congress of the United States, in the early 1789, the early 1790s, it was Madison who introduced most legislation. He was the clear and convincing leader in the Congress and the first to go up against Alexander Hamilton's economic policies and consolidating policies that Madison first and then Jefferson second believed would destroy the virtue and the very meaning, essence of the American Revolution.
Andrew Burstein is with us. He is Charles P. Manship Professor of History at LSU. Nancy Eisenberg is here as well. She's Professor of History at LSU. The book that they have just written is called Madison and Jefferson. We'll resume our conversation in just a couple of minutes. Right now, we would invite you to give us a call at 1-888-694-6931. You can also go online to kera.org, make a contribution of support in support of this station that brings you such great in-depth content every single day of the year. We do have copies, Jeff Whittington, available of Madison and Jefferson at the $120 level today.
We do indeed. If you call 888-694-6931, if you go online to kera.org, make your contribution at the $120 membership level, we will gladly send you your very own copy of Madison and Jefferson. Of course, we're thanking you at that level with this book. We're certainly not selling you a copy of the book for $120. And with all the thank you gifts that are available, and if you've heard one during the drive over the last couple of weeks that you're interested in, go ahead and check it out online. It's probably still available. Or call 888-694-6931.
Your contribution keeps KERA strong. If you have not made a contribution in the past, the reason that you're able to listen is because someone else has stepped up in the past and said, yes, I believe in public radio. I believe it's an important resource for any strong and vibrant community. Your contribution today makes it possible for us to continue this service for you and for the rest of North Texas. It just takes a couple of minutes if you want to go online at kera.org. You can check out the thank you gifts that we have been talking about today, including Madison and Jefferson. You can also check out anything else, pretty much anything else that we've discussed during this drive. Most of it is still available. You can also call us at 1-888-694-6931 if you want to know something else about membership to KERA.
Special thanks to Olin Fragia in Hawkins, Glenn Trotter in Arlington, also Doty Darcy in Dallas. We've heard from each of them. Also Polly Prado in Farmers Branch, Mark Milliken in Dallas. Folks, we have $220,000 left to raise in the overall $700,000 goal. That means that we are getting really close. And those of you who've waited to make your contribution when we can race to the finish, please help start that race right now by calling 888-694-6931 or by contributing online this afternoon at kera.org.
We love being able to bring this content to you. It is a privilege for us. It's fun for us. We know that you appreciate being able to turn on your radio every day at noon and hear something substantive and interesting and something that involves you and what you want to know about the world. Please help us to continue this service. 1-888-694-6931 is the telephone number, or you can do this online at kera.org. I want to thank David Shockley in Royce City and Patricia Raven in Flower Mound, Beth Rainey in Dallas, and Stacey Reeves in Frisco for their contributions.
We are 69% of the way there. We need your call right now to 888-694-6931 to get a little bit closer. Of course, your online contribution at kera.org helps as well, and thank you so much.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education, announcing a 9-month intensive CFP certificate program starting in January in Plano. You can learn more at smu.edu/PlanoCFP.
Yeah. You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Nancy Eisenberg, professor of history at Louisiana State University, along with Andrew Burstein, Charles P. Manship professor of history at Louisiana State University. They are co-authors of the new book, Madison and Jefferson. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, we'd love to hear from you at 1-800-933-5372. You can also get to us via email to think@kera.org. The two, of course, would have heard of one another, known of one another, but they first met a few months after Jefferson drafted the Declaration of Independence. Can you tell us about the early days of that relationship?
Well, what few people don't realize is that even though they were both sons of the, you know, the Virginia gentry, they had connections to slavery. They had both sort of been part of the literary culture that was a mark of status among the Virginia elite. Their connection at that time was through a man whose name was Edmund Pendleton, who tends to be forgotten, even though he was in many ways the first unofficial governor or leader in Virginia during the American Revolution. And this is the other thing we try to uncover about Jefferson and Madison, is their connections to important Virginians, the way in which not only do we challenge the traditional biography, but looking at the relationship of these two men, but we put them in a larger circle of influential Virginians and how they exchanged letters and how they influenced their ideas. And what's striking about the Revolution is that the impact of the Revolution would carry on and have influence on the lives and thinking of Madison and Jefferson well into the 19th century. They very much looked at the Revolution not only as a rebellion against tyranny, not only as connected to the imperial threats of the British on their colonies or their heavy-handed response to the rebellion in Massachusetts. They were really pushed into the Revolution because the last royal governor, Lord Dunmore, decided to wage class war against the Virginia planter elite. He mobilized an army and issued a proclamation claiming he was going to free all slaves and servants if they came to support his side. And this, in a sense, sparked the Virginians, made slavery and the issue of slavery central to their concern about what the Revolution was about, which is why that Jefferson, when he finally gets around to writing the Declaration of Independence, will have to write a defense of Virginians, explaining that the slave trade had been imposed on the colonies and that the British were really to blame.
And what happened during the Revolution was that although Jefferson and Madison knew one another through Pendleton, and who was kind of the clearinghouse of information. Jefferson was in Philadelphia writing the Declaration at the Continental Congress. Madison was in the colonial capital of Williamsburg dealing with Virginia's Declaration of Independence, which preceded by a few weeks Jefferson's Declaration of Independence. And it was Pendleton, this man whom we feature early in the book, who not only connected Madison and Jefferson and who knew both of their parents, he was a slightly older man, but he was the one who directed Jefferson in Philadelphia as a result of Madison's and others, Virginians' participation in Williamsburg, directed Jefferson to declare independence on behalf of Virginia. So that's how the communication begins. Jefferson becomes governor of Virginia in 1779, really the dark days of the war. Benedict Arnold will invade Virginia during Jefferson's administration. And it was at that moment, in 1779, that Madison was named to the Council of Advisors, the governor's advisors, and became Jefferson's closest advisor in the dark days of the war. So they cemented a political bond at that time, although their personal bond developed in ensuing years, especially when Jefferson was America's ambassador in France in the middle years of the 1780s, and Madison was either in Congress in Philadelphia or he was working with the Virginia planter elite on issues that both Jefferson and he had in common, such as the Virginia Statute for Religious Freedom, which is a precursor of the separation of church and state and the First Amendment to the Constitution. So Jefferson was half a world away, and through their letter writing, and Jefferson would buy all kinds of books for Madison and satisfy his intellectual needs, they became alter egos, political alter egos. And while they didn't agree on everything, they recognized that they were a great tag team. They supported one another emotionally, publicly, and you know, it was a 50-year friendship, and probably, arguably, the most important political friendship between any two individuals in American history.
And we should note here that there wasn't just an automatic fraternity of powerful men from Virginia, because, of course, Patrick Henry was a huge presence in Virginia, serving as governor just before Jefferson, and then was very important in the American Revolution, but had a lot of political and ideological conflicts, rather, with Madison and Jefferson.
Yeah, Henry is an important figure who also tends to get left out of the story. I mean, everyone recognizes his earlier, you know, rallying cry to provoke Virginians to the revolution, but they tend to forget his later role, and particularly his major role in the Virginia, you know, the Virginia Assembly, because there he was a very potent and powerful force. He was known for his incredible oratory. And what we find so remarkable is that at the beginning of the Revolution, Madison really sided with Henry and his radicalism when he mobilized, you know, men in Virginia to stand up to Lord Dunmore. But later he realizes that Henry always seems to be on the opposite side, challenging any reform that Madison is trying to promote. And eventually, in anticipation of the Constitutional Convention, Madison would put together this very important political treatises listing all the vices of the Confederation. He did studies on ancient governments to sort of substantiate his argument. And when he talked about one of the most glaring vices in the Confederation, he had one man in mind, and that was Patrick Henry, because he saw Patrick Henry as a demagogue. He saw him as someone who, through his personal seductive ways as well as his powerful oratory, could control men with weaker minds and less firm convictions. And this is what's often forgotten about Madison, that his abstract ideas were usually based on real experiences and real people.
There's a great vignette, a great episode in when Jefferson is in France in the mid-1780s, and Madison's keeping him up to date on Patrick Henry's activities. Because whatever Madison and Jefferson believed in, no matter what it was, Henry was the spoiler. He took the opposite view. He was a thorn in their side. And Jefferson writes to Madison, what we have to do is pray devoutly for his death. And, you know, this gives you a sense not only of the Jefferson-Madison, I mean, the fact that they can come clean with one another and say things that are sometimes vulgar and certainly aren't politic. They recognized that politics from Virginia to the national government had to be taken care of in secret. You come up with, people did not campaign for election in early America. They didn't run for office. They stood for office. The only time they gave speeches was to their local constituents. That's, again, we're stressing the Virginia angle here, that they were Virginians first. But on the national level, Henry dies in 1799, the same season that George Washington dies. But Washington tries to bring Henry back from retirement to stand up to Jefferson and Madison as they're gaining strength. And so for Henry's entire career, he's the guy who's brought into the ring when the more conservative opponents at the national or the local level want to stop Madison and Jefferson. In fact, Henry was responsible for preventing James Madison from serving as United States Senator in the first Congress. And he tried to get Madison bounced even from the House of Representatives. So Patrick Henry is a fascinating counterpoint to the Madison-Jefferson friendship.
So by 1796, when Jefferson ultimately would run for president unsuccessfully the first time and become vice president, he had said that he was out of politics. He was tired. He felt not as healthy as he used to. What role did James Madison have in convincing Jefferson to run for the highest office in the country?
Yeah, this was not completely unusual. Jefferson had done this before. I mean, after he had been governor from Virginia and he had been criticized publicly and accused of cowardice and sort of, you know, abandoning his office and running away from the British, he retreated, and he was angry, and he felt that he didn't want to return to politics. And the same basic response occurred after Jefferson had left the cabinet. He felt horrible about being in Washington's cabinet. He had been involved in long arguments, constant disputes. He felt that Hamilton sucked the air out of the room every time the cabinet left, and he retreated to Virginia. But Madison would write to Jefferson. He even wrote letters saying, I know that Jefferson is going to resist returning to politics, but he refused to give up. He refused to back down in convincing Jefferson to run. Jefferson even argued that Madison should run, which at that moment, you know, Madison didn't believe it was the right thing to do. And it also reflects that, you know, Jefferson was looking for any kind of argument to not return to politics. But that doesn't mean that Jefferson didn't have ambition.
In 1796, when John Adams is running for president, and Washington is retired, and John Adams is running for president, and Jefferson, Madison convinces Jefferson to come up against him. Jefferson is friends with Adams. They have kind of an on-again, off-again friendship, where they both seem to allow for their differences by recurring to the way they stood together side by side in 1776. They never forgot that. But Madison, even before he'd met Adams, despised Adams. He called him vain and obnoxious. And Jefferson wanted to send a congratulatory letter to Adams when Adams narrowly defeated Jefferson for the presidency that year. And Madison says, no, absolutely do not send this letter. You know, we're the opposition. So once again, you know, it's Madison's partisan colors that come through, and here Jefferson believes in you know, the semblance of bipartisanship.
Let me have you pause right there, and we'll pick it up. We just need to take a quick break. Nancy Eisenberg and Andrew Burstein are my guests. Both are professors of history at LSU. Their new book is called Madison and Jefferson. We'll resume our conversation with them in just a couple of minutes and welcome you to join us by calling 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org. Jeff Whittington is back with us now. He is senior producer of Think and host of Anything You Ever Wanted to Know. Hey, Jeff.
Hey, Chris. And thanks to everyone for joining us today for this fascinating conversation about the other side, the more realistic side of two legendary founders of our great country. It's fascinating, and I think we're dangerously treading into the, well, I'm not going to call and support the station territory because I don't want to miss anything territory. So
you got a couple of minutes here.
Right now we're in the it's safe to call 888-694-6931 territory. It's safe. You're not going to miss any of the great conversation if you go online to kera.org territory and make your contribution. Join at the $120 membership level today. That's just $10 a month. And you get your very own copy of Madison and Jefferson by Andrew Burstein and Nancy Eisenberg. It's fascinating, and you can get your copy and support KERA at the same time. You just have to make that call or online contribution.
This is such a novel approach to that relationship, and it's as fascinating as this discussion is, reading the book will give you even more information, so we hope that you will consider that. We'd love to hear from you now at 1-888-694-6931 or online at kera.org. Another option, if perhaps you already have picked up a copy of this book, is that we have the This American Life combo. We have the Squirrel Seeks Chipmunk, the brand new book of, he calls it a bestiary, David Sedaris. He doesn't call it a book of fables. And also a This American Life USB with it's 2G and it's loaded with 35 classic episodes of This American Life. So great if you're going on a road trip or something and you want to, you know, pop that into whatever format you'd like to play things. That's available for a $120 contribution this afternoon, which obviously is $10 a month if you do the sustaining membership plan. You can find out about all of that online at kera.org or when you call 1-888-694-6931.
And Chris knows wherefore she speaks about David Sedaris because she got to hang out with him.
It's an interesting
last time
character,
he was in town.
Yeah. He's great. He's actually much much friendlier when you meet him than you might imagine.
He does 30 appearances in 30 days typically, and that is a big chunk of work. And he carries just enough laundry to get through a day or two. He likes his laundry to be being done.
He does it backstage. Because
yes.
He says every theater has laundry facilities,
that's
and
right.
why go hunt down a laundromat?
Exactly. He should get together and do a thing with Rick Steves where they talk about how to, you know, efficient size. Anyway, I digress. We want to thank Arendon Bose and Allen, Chelsea White and Arlington. They are the most recent callers to toll-free 1-888-694-6931 or, of course, free to go online and make your contribution at kera.org.
Thank you also to Gaurav Khatri and in Dallas and Tim Snyder in Coppell and Stephanie Moore in Fort Worth. We would love to be able to read your name, and all you have to do is make your contribution now at 1-888-694-6931 or go online to kera.org. By the way, we don't have to read your name. If for some reason you don't want that out there, there's an option on the website, and you can tell the person on the phone, I want to make this contribution, but please don't read my name, and we're happy to comply. So if that's stopping you, don't let it.
And just in case Rollins Gilliland's listening, who he's going to be on this afternoon, I'm excited, Rollins, because we're building the momentum as more and more listeners step up to the plate all over the listening area. Those are two things that Rollins has promised on his Facebook status today not to say on the air this afternoon. So I just wanted to go ahead and give him that. But you can call 888-694-6931. You should go online right now to kera.org and make that contribution.
It just takes a couple of minutes. We promise if you start it right now, be done by the time we come back right after our underwriting announcements in about 2 minutes. We'd love to hear from you now at kera.org. Thanks.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education, announcing a 9-month intensive CFP certificate program starting in January in Plano. You can learn more at smu.edu/PlanoCFP.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Andrew Burstein and Nancy Eisenberg are with us this afternoon. Both are professors of history at Louisiana State University and co-authors of the new book Madison and Jefferson. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372. And before the break, Nancy, you were filling us in more about Madison's response to John Adams' victory in the presidential election of 1796.
Yeah, just a few extra points. One is that we see Madison as really becoming Jefferson's handler, advising him not to put in writing something that might later come back to bite him. He basically told Jefferson that the contents of the letter would be leaked to Adams, which it was. He asked someone to tell Madison what's in the letter. And we begin to see this relationship that's important and, you know, again, an innovation that's occurring in politics at the time.
How did Madison, known today as Father of the Constitution, respond to the objections that Jefferson had to ratification?
Yeah, I think what we try to do with the argument about the Father of the Constitution is that this metaphor is inaccurate. Even in his own retelling, he's not the hero of the convention. And we like to compare him to a frustrated composer whose grand symphony is left unfinished because almost every key feature of the Virginia plan, you know, this is the plan that he helped compose with two other Virginians and brought to the convention for his vision of how the Articles of Confederation could be changed, were rejected. So that's where we begin, that it's misleading to see him as the father that he lost. And remarkably, he stayed behind even after these major defeats when many other delegates of the convention did leave town. Now, the other interesting thing is that they're fundamentally different at this stage, and we also highlight this because they also had basic philosophical differences. Jefferson was afraid that tyranny came from the top. Madison felt tyranny came from the bottom, and he really wanted the new Constitution to play a disciplinary role in checking the excesses of rogue states who were violating the terms of the Articles of the Articles of Confederation.
Let's go to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. We'll speak with Ken in Plano. Hi, Ken.
Yes, hi. I'm going to try to squeeze in two questions. I'll make it really quick. I wonder if you could talk very briefly about teasing out new stories from source material that may be thoroughly picked over. Talk about that process of sort of finding new stories about these men who are so famous. And number two, good Lord, you folks know this material better than anybody. What's it like for you to turn on the news and watch, certain commentators appropriating the images and words of these people who are so famous in our history, but people know so little about?
Thanks for your call.
Well, great questions. The first question concerning the sources that we used. Well, I've written two books on Jefferson before, so I wouldn't have gotten involved in this had I not found enough that was fresh and original. We love reading the newspapers. I mean, the newspapers of 1780 and 1790 and 1800. Sometimes we go to archives and read them in hard copy. Now, in select university libraries, you can have all of these digitized. You can plug in a keyword, let's say pursuit of happiness, a key phrase, and it would tell you every newspaper in whatever year you select that refers to the pursuit of happiness and in what context. So the way a historian is trained is to understand and appreciate context, not to believe that these 18th century people reflected universal emotions and what they felt is precisely what we felt. Their very vocabulary differs markedly from ours. The way we define one word, they would define it differently. And so there are just so many things you can do as a historian by analyzing language and by, frankly, using the Internet and digitized newspapers to uncover debates and personalities and show how different things were from what the historic imagination has taught us. We have a very short historic memory, we Americans, and so history has to be constantly rewritten. We need to understand what the priorities were of the men who wrote the Constitution, the men who fought the Revolution. Their priorities were not ours. Anyway, I'll let Nancy respond to the second question.
And the question, yeah, Nancy, was about the relationship between politicians today. We should say nobody pulled any punches back then in criticizing either man, particularly Thomas Jefferson.
Yeah, no, the politics was nastier than it is today. There were no rules. You didn't have the objective sources. Sexual slurs were sort of used to attack political candidates. So the newspaper culture really has had a great deal of influence in shaping the world and shaping partisan politics. Now, we shouldn't be surprised because we know that's true today when we look at the powerful influence of the media. But it often tends to be ignored when popularizers are writing about the founders. They tend to see them in isolation or only read their personal letters and don't put them into the broader political context where their ideas are not only reacting to their colleagues and friends in Virginia, but they're also reacting to what's written in the newspapers. And that's another way we've tried to change this story.
They conceal their emotions, and that's why the biographer must be a cultural historian capable of understanding context and not identifying too readily with the nobility, the greatness of an 18th century individual. bitterness, political bitterness. They had their crackpots. They had brawlers on the floor of the House. In 1797, one spat on another and got slammed with a cane. The occasional duel, the heavy drinkers, speeches that went a lot longer than the speeches we hear in Congress today. Newspapers fanned the flames in the same way that that we see on cable news today. But because it was a 3-mile-an-hour world, there was a lot less posturing before the camera, as it were. Politicians spoke through letters that made it into the public realm and were publicized that way intentionally, which is another reason why we say they concealed their emotions. They wrote private letters that were, in fact, designed to be released to the public, and you have to interpret them properly in that manner.
What? No, and I would just add one comment to that. This also becomes an issue during the ratifying convention, that Madison participates in Virginia. Jefferson is still in France. And because Jefferson is leaning in the direction that he doesn't want the last remaining states to ratifying the convention, he's even open to the idea of holding a second convention. And these ideas are anathema to Madison's thinking. Jefferson ends up circulating letters. He writes letters that he gives to Virginians that end up are supposed to have influence in Maryland, supposed to have influence in Virginia, and embarrasses Madison. Basically, Patrick Henry reads from the letter from Jefferson during the Virginia ratifying convention, and he makes Madison squirm. And Madison has to come up with a response saying he knows Jefferson's ideas better. So this is another example of how letter writing becomes politicized. And also one of the themes we do address in our book is that Madison and Jefferson were not mirror images of one another. They had crucial philosophical differences, and at certain political moments, these differences emerge and shape the policy that they end up promoting.
I'll tell you one thing that reminds us of today. Madison and Jefferson's allies were constantly called mad Democrats. They were their opponents. Well, they called one another artful and wicked. The opposition, the Hamiltonians, Washington's party. Jefferson and Madison referred to as timid Tories. So they, you know, the kind of colorful language they used is reflected somewhat in the sound bites that we hear on the TV these days.
Andrew Burstein is Charles P. Manship Professor of History at Louisiana State University. Nancy Eisenberg is Professor of History also at Louisiana State University. Their new book is called Madison and Jefferson. Andy, Nancy, it's been a really interesting hour. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Chris. We had a good time.
Yeah, thank you for having us.
Thanks to all of you who have participated today, either by listening, by calling or writing in, or by calling or going online to make a contribution of financial support to KERA. We run on donations here. That's how the station stays strong and vibrant and how we've been able to provide this programming for you for all these decades, because people have decided that no community is complete in this country without the presence of a really good public radio station. KERA is your public radio station here in North Texas. So we would ask that you go online now to kera.org or call 1-888-694-6931. Choose a thank you gift if you like. Among the things we have to offer today are this brand new book, Madison and Jefferson, available at the $120 level. Hey, Jeff.
Hey, Chris. You're right. It is a thank you gift we're offering today because obviously we talked with Professors Burstein and Eisenberg this hour, and we thought you might be interested in this topic of conversation, and that's why they were our guests today. You play an important role in every decision we make. Who would the listeners, who would you want to hear on the show? Who might you like to interact with as a caller to the show or an emailer to the show? Who would you, what topic would you get something out of? What questions would you ask if you were able to talk to these guests? Those are all things that Chris and I think about on a daily basis, many times throughout the day. because you play such an important role in the station's success as a contributor, but also as a listener. This content is all crafted for you, and that's why we don't have a problem asking you to send money to the station by calling 888-694-6931 or by going online to KERA.org and contributing there.
We feel really lucky because you and our audience are smart and well-educated, sometimes self-educated, sometimes formally educated. You're curious about a variety of things, and I am not really just blowing smoke at you. It makes it possible for us to do programs like this. We don't have to dumb anything down, which is a delight and very different from other places you might work in broadcasting. However, we also would ask that if you are in this audience, if you believe in the importance of public radio, if you recognize that it's not dumbed down and that it is diverse and respectful of differing ideas, we would ask that you please step forward and contribute something so that public radio can remain strong in this community. We would love to hear from you now at 1-888-694-6931 or online at kera.org. You can join Jennifer Holmes from Coppell, Kia Johnson in Fort Worth, Faisal Mirza in McKinney, and Alan Tomlinson in Dallas.
888-694-6931, online at kera.org. Please don't wait, especially now. Don't think that someone else is going to do it. We are $219,000 away from finishing this drive. We know that there are those of you who hang out and wait till what could be the last day or two. We've done close to 150 in a day before. So, Chris, we're really like in the last few days of the drive right now because we know there are many of you who are waiting. And when we reach that magic number, you're going to call 888-694-6931. But I would ask that you please just go ahead and do it now. So if you're planning to contribute during this drive, please go ahead and do it now so that we can get this thing over with and move on to incredible, in-depth election coverage. Of course, you're still going to get great election coverage this month from KERA, but we'll have the full range of the hour, the full range of Morning Edition, the full range of the Diane Rehm Show, and All Things Considered to bring you that important news and information. Call 888-694-6931 or go online to KERA.org. Please do it now.
When you go into a store and you buy an object, you are obtaining that thing and you own it and it's yours and you're sort of paying for the cost of producing it. It's very similar with this station. You're not exactly buying KERA, but you are certainly paying for the production of quality radio that you count on. And you're really making an investment in something that continues to pay dividends to you throughout the year. A lot of you like to make the contribution every year on your credit or debit card, which is great for us because we take the money and immediately put it to work. Some of you prefer to spread it out, also great because we know that, you know, we can count on that money coming in every month. However you choose to do it, your support really makes a difference. If you think public radio should be here, if you'd be appalled if it weren't here, imagine the importance of your contribution at 1-888-694-6931.
We know that you seek out perspectives that differ from your own or from the perspectives you hear in most other mainstream media. And that's why we will take a look at from many different angles at a topic. Next hour's topic is an example of that, how you and the rest of us are able to perform better or not so well.
It's about choking under pressure.
at difficult times. Right now, we're...
Don't choke.
Yeah, we're hoping that you'll dial that number, 888-694-6931, or go online to kera.org. You know, you might choose, and I know Chris knows a little bit about this, to pick up the People's Pharmacy book, Recipes and...
Remedies.
Yeah. At the $120 membership level.
This was really a big item this weekend, I understand. And this is the new book by Joe and Terry Graydon of the People's Pharmacy. This is not yet available in stores. And, you know, some of the items that we talk about, you could run down to a bookstore and pick up. This one, you can only get at this point through contributions to public radio. You can get it at the $120 level. There are all these great recipes for foods that really have been shown to be effective in dealing with things like regulating your blood sugar, perhaps in addition to what your doctor has prescribed to you. Things like working on cholesterol and joint pain, all kinds of things that you can eat. And who wouldn't rather have food than medicine? So you might want to try that. It's available at the $120 level now at kera.org.
And you'll also be supporting KERA. It's 90.1 KERA, Dallas, Fort Worth, Denton, also 100.1 K261 CW in Tyler, 88.3 K202 DR in Wichita Falls, and 99.3 K257 EV in Sherman.
Your contribution at 1-888-694-6931 or online at kera.org not only supports public radio for the year, for you, for your family, and for the rest of North Texas, it also brings us that much closer to ending the membership campaign for the fall, and I think we'd all like to see that happen as soon as possible. We really appreciate your support. Again, the number, 1-888-694-6931. Thanks.
The Think production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.